This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. If Jason Padgett's story weren't backed up by scientific evidence, it would be almost unbelievable. 11 years ago, he was mugged and severely beaten. Afterward, he suffered from lingering health problems, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder. That's not the unbelievable part. He also sustained a traumatic brain injury that actually activated an area of his brain. The result is a combination of synesthesia, the merging of senses, and acquired savant syndrome. In plain English, he now sees the world as math. Geometric shapes and complex equations are everywhere in Jason Padgett's world. Of course, there have been trade-offs. While Jason's mathematical abilities have been elevated to the genius level, his writing skills have deteriorated. So he enlisted the help of fellow synesthete and journalist Maureen Seberg to write his memoirs. The book is called Struck by Genius: How a Brain Injury Made Me a Mathematical Marvel. I recently spoke with Jason Padgett and Maureen Seberg about this remarkable story. Jason, your story starts to some degree with what was really quite a brutal attack. Can you tell us what happened that night as you left, I take it, a karaoke night at a bar?
Yeah, I had some friends, or a girl that she was on a first date with this guy, and she called me wanting to get a ride home because they'd been drinking too much, so I went to this little karaoke bar. I wound up singing a song and then having a Coke and then leaving. And as we left, these two guys were behind us, and they didn't look too freaky. I mean, a little bit, but not too bad. But anyway, I just never expected anything, and they attacked me from behind. I didn't see it coming at all. The girl, Angela, she said that she saw the guy run up behind me with the other guy, and the first one just slugged me right in the back of the head. And from my perspective, all I was doing was just walking. The next thing I knew, I saw a flash of light, felt this deep thud in the back of my head, and the next thing I knew, I was on my knees trying to figure out, you know, how I got on my knees, why I was there, what was going on, why I was being hit. You know, it was really confusing because even though it was like I was only unconscious from like standing to my knees, coming to still like you're just not with it whatsoever. And I remember thinking that I was being attacked by a gang, like a whole group of people, and then slowly realizing that it was, you know, two people because of the different directions I was getting hit and as I came to. And then the next thing I remember seeing this guy's basically like his thighs and like his belt buckle type of area right in front of me. And I remember thinking that I was going to die right then. And then the next thought that I had was I want to hurt one of these guys before I die, because I was so sure that was it. All I could think of is I have no choice but to try to at least do some sort of damage before I get killed. And I grabbed the guy's leg and I bit him on the inside of the thigh. And he had these baggy pants on, so the first time I bit, all I got was cloth, and my teeth hit together and chipped my teeth. And then I took a second bite and actually finally got meat. And if somehow, you know, during that, he had fallen down and I was like on top of him, and the other guy just started kicking me repeatedly, you know, while I was biting that guy, just trying to do whatever I could. And then finally one of them said, after this was probably like 30 to 45 seconds, maybe of fighting, and one of them yelled, the guy behind me yelled, give me your jacket. And I literally just let go of his friend, threw my jacket off, and rolled off of him, and they grabbed it and ran away.
That's all they were after, was just your jacket.
Yeah, well, when I paid my bill inside, I took my wallet out of my jacket, inside jacket pocket, but when I put it away, I put it in my pants pocket. So I think they were after the wallet.
You thought you were going to die. You didn't die, clearly.
Right.
But you were severely injured.
Right. So there was a hospital literally right across the street, 100 feet across from the place, and I went there, and they diagnosed me with a severe concussion and a bleeding kidney and gave me some pain medicine and sent me home that night.
What was your recovery from this like, and at what point did you realize that this was not your average concussion or brain injury?
At first, everything, I thought it was the pain medicine that was making everything look different. And then the next morning when I woke up, then I was absolutely positive it wasn't. Because everything, instead of looking like smooth and continuous, it looks jittery. The best way I can think of describing it is like being aware of picture frames, but in real time. Like if you were hitting pause on your TV, like repeatedly, and each time you hit pause, you can see the next picture frame. It's like that, but just in real time.
You're watching real life in freeze frame.
Yes, that's the best way to describe it. And if I mentally overlay like a grid structure, like a lattice, on top of everything that I'm looking at, as long as I make the lattice sufficiently fine, all the movements across my field of vision will line up with a vertex point on this lattice. It kind of makes everything not super pixelated, but obviously attached to a grid, grid-like. So pixelated might be too strong of a word, because people, I think, when they think pixelated, they think super pixelated. But it makes everything obviously grid-like.
Did you think this is something that would just go away, that you would deal with on your own?
At the time, the worst thing was the post-traumatic stress. Instantly, I was just, like, angry. I felt completely violated. I didn't want to go anywhere. I was totally agoraphobic, and that was immediately. I didn't want to go outside. I didn't want to be around people. It was like my entire trust in society was crushed, because during the middle of it, I looked up at Angela on her date, and I said, "Help." And she was frozen in this, like, her knees bent and her arms bent, and her mouth was this perfect little circle. She was totally in shock, like just frozen in shock, which I understand. And when I said help, she actually jerked into motion and ran inside the restaurant, I'm assuming, to try to get help. And the guy that was with her, who was a decent-sized guy, too, and there was only two guys attacking me, he put his hands up, like in the surrender motion, turned around like a robot with his back to us, and walked away. Like, "I don't want any part of this," turn around and just walked away. And then, after it happened, I actually yelled at them and was, I would have appreciated any type of help, even just screaming at them to try to distract them, anything besides just, "Hey, you're on your own." And, but at the same time, I understand people's fear. But at the time, it was just like, wow, there's people inside the restaurant watching and people right there, and you feel safe. Because you're in public, and this is a business, and you're not, and people won't always come to you, to your aid, even if you're a victim of a crime like that. So that was just overwhelming.
Did you seek therapy, professional help in dealing with your PTSD?
Eventually, I did. But what it was that actually made me go in was OCD. OCD came with it, and it was just like, just because everything looks different, and maybe also from post-traumatic stress beyond, it was like constant information coming in a completely different way, and I was noticing just minor details of all sorts of things. And so, like, what I didn't notice before about, transfer of germs, suddenly that became, like, obvious, But then I would start to analyze it and overanalyze it, and then before you know it, I was literally, like, Lysoling my money, putting it in the microwave for 30 seconds to kill the germs, Didn't want to leave the house, Didn't want to touch anything that somebody else had touched, It was very bad. And so anyway, those things combined, eventually I was like, this is ridiculous, because even though when you have OCD, you know it's silly, but for some reason it's like your body is stuck on this fight or flight. You know how, like, when you're attacked, you go into fight or flight? It's like being permanently stuck in that position, where you're always on edge. And so I did go see a psychologist who helped a lot with that stuff.
Was it immediately apparent to your psychologist that what was going on was more than just run-of-the-mill PTSD, if there is such a thing, there was perhaps a deeper neurological...
Yeah, I went in there with the drawings and everything. I showed her the drawings, explained it all, everything. She'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah, what was her reaction?
Her reaction, just like to the number stuff, is... at first it sounds like, what? But then when you look at it, and I go through and I show you that it really is pi, and this really is, if this, constraint really is there, then that would be the structure of space-time. It all is correct, But then again, the post-traumatic stress, that's something that had to be dealt with, and the OCD that for some reason came with this. I have noticed a lot, the higher I get in math classes, the more OCD and things like that I see. So I think there's some sort of correlation between it, at least tics, like weird, odd little tics. The higher you get in math classes, the more of those odd tics it seems that everybody has.
Maureen Seberg, at what point did you encounter Jason's story and meet Jason?
Jason had gone through about 3 years of self-imposed isolation following the attack. He had some really dark, terrible days. But at one point, he decided to make a video of himself drawing these beautiful geometric forms that he sees all the time. And he uploaded it onto YouTube. I believe it was around November 9th, 2010. And I had set up a synesthesia Google alert on my email for research purposes. And pretty soon after he uploaded the video, it landed in my inbox. And I clicked, and though I am a synesthete and someone who blogs on synesthesia for Psychology Today and knows what a lot of other synesthete friends experience, I was absolutely blown away by the complexity of his visions. I had never seen anything so intricate in the synesthesia world.
So explain for us what synesthesia is and how it manifests for you.
Okay, thanks. Synesthesia is a blending of the senses. If you're stimulated with one sensory input, such as listening to music, you will hear music just as other normal people hear it, but you will have an additional sensory response. So in my case, that is to see colored moving shapes. In Jason's case, he seems stimulated by numbers and formulas that create these complex images for him. There are actually more than 60 types of synesthesia cataloged to date, and more all the time are coming out as people talk about this more.
Now, Jason, in addition to the synesthesia or perhaps connected with it, and in addition to the OCD and the post-traumatic stress disorder, you were eventually diagnosed with something called Savant syndrome. So explain that for us.
Savant syndrome is just like basically where you're highly skilled, but in one really tiny specific area. A lot of times people think of like the Rain Man, and he was skilled in so many ways that there's also some very large drawbacks. But it really just means that you're highly skilled like in this one area. Sometimes they would even call it, even though it's not a nice way to say it, you know, a long time ago they would say idiot savant, you know, because somebody could, you could hold up a number and they could say whether it was a prime number or not, but they couldn't dress themselves and get by with their everyday needs.
Now, you've experienced, obviously not to that severity, but some trade-offs in terms of how your brain seems to work, what is interesting, what you, what are your strong points. To really make the point of how much things have changed, though, let's go back and describe what were you like before the attack? What were your interests before this happened?
Yeah. Literally, I mean, life was just, I goofed off and that was it. I mean, I went out every single night. I mean, literally almost 7 days a week with friends to bars, skiing, skydiving, anything that was like adrenaline-based and just goofed off, literally. I did not care about math. In fact, I remember cheating in school, you know, just to get by in the classes that I had.
Okay, so then
would ask me something about math, and I would always say, you know, what is that good for? Or the other one that I would always say was, how does that apply in the real world? How are you really going to actually use that to make a living? You know, and I just can't believe how ignorant it was to think that way and to not be able to see this. It's just, it's so obvious now that it's like, how could I not see it? You know, it's crazy.
So describe for us now, fast forward a few years, and we've talked a little bit about, you know, seeing the world as attached to a grid and kind of more pixelated or in freeze frame. But in the beginning of your book, to really illustrate this, you describe your morning routine. And I wonder if you could walk us through just the beginning of your day, what some of the mundane household things like washing your face, stirring your coffee, what those look like to you?
I just did that. I just watched the coffee swirl when I put the soy milk in there and how it is this fractal. In fact, I've drawn it out on my site on Fine Art America where it shows like a spiral as just these progressively smaller right angles, and it's a recursive form of the Pythagorean theorem. But it used to, like, when things would spiral like clouds, it would look smooth. Now there's this jagged boundary around the edge, so it looks so obvious, like little straight tangent lines. So instead of this smooth curving spiral, it's these beautiful little tangents, which then makes it really obvious, this recursive form of the Pythagorean theorem. Once you see it that way in frames, it changes it from this smooth continuous thing to chopped up segments, which then you can measure, you know, and so it just jumps out at you, you know, the direct or the correlation between it and whatever equation.
You've also said that you see coastlines as fractals.
Yeah, coastline is the same problem as pi. Pi, what we're doing is we're, you know, inscribing a square with inside a circle or a polygon. But you can keep adding sides smaller and smaller and smaller to a circle forever. A good way to think about it is like if you're seeing a circle on TV, it's actually made from right triangles because your TV is made with little, you know, rectangle or square pixels, and you cut those corner to corner, it's two right triangles. So whenever you see a circle on TV, it's not a circle. It has a little zigzag around the edge. And that zigzag is just so small relative to you that you think it's a curve. But you can make the pixels half that size and half that size and half that size and keep making them half their size all the way to infinity, and you forever approach closer and closer to a curve, but you never reach it. And that's that same problem with the coastline. If I want to measure the coastline of a country, this is a fractal problem, you could use a yardstick. But what happens when you get to a curve in the coastline that's like, say, a half a foot? You can't get that yardstick in to measure that curve. So now you use a yardstick that's a foot long, and you get a more accurate measurement. And the smaller, and so you can keep making, of course, the yardstick smaller and smaller and smaller to infinity. And each time you make that yardstick smaller, the circumference of the country or coastline gets longer. So just like pi, it gets longer for infinity, but by smaller and smaller amounts.
That's Jason Padgett. He's the subject and, along with Maureen Seberg, co-author of Struck by Genius, How a Brain Injury Made Me a Mathematical Marvel. You're listening to Living Lab. More after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Imagine waking up one day and suddenly seeing geometric patterns and mathematical equations overlaid or perhaps embedded in everything you see. That's what happened to Jason Padgett after a rather unusual brain injury. The former college dropout now talks about pi like an old friend. Padgett's transformation is the subject of a new biography co-authored by Maureen Seberg. It's entitled Struck by Genius, How a Brain Injury Made Me a Mathematical Marvel. I recently spoke with Maureen Seberg and Jason Padgett.
When you started seeing the world in a different way, were all of these terms and equations that you now seem so comfortable with immediately apparent to you, or did you need to go look up and learn what it was you were looking at?
Yeah, I mean, at first all I would say is that looks like a piece of pi. That looks like a piece of pi at a different value, because I would draw pi but with a different amount of triangles. And by drawing it with different amounts of triangles, it makes different angles and different types of triangles within it. And so I'd be watching TV and I would see that I could take that picture apart. If I drew pi like 30 different ways and then used all the shapes that are made within it, I could build that picture. And so was the only way I had to say it, was that looks like a piece of pie at this, until eventually I went back to school and started learning how to write equations. How it happened was I went to Subway to have a sandwich, and one of the few times I was out, and I was drawing, and a guy came by, and he asked me what I was doing and said it looked really mathy, and he said he was a physicist. And he asked me what type of classes I had, and then, of course, I launched into that. All I had was pre-algebra, but I just told them everything, you know, about what I was thinking, about how a circle worked and what pi was. And anyway, he convinced me to go back to school. He was basically saying that you've got to learn, you know, how to say it in equation, or else there's just no way to prove it. What you're doing here certainly looks like it's true, but to prove it, you're going to have to put it in equation form. And so he convinced me to go enroll in school, and I went and enrolled in just Algebra 99 at TCC. And the first day, I remember she graphed an equation, and I said, so you're telling me that every equation, you know, is always just describing the geometry of something that's occurring in the universe? And she said, yes. And I was like, so then we're speaking about the same thing. It's just geometry is the natural form of the equation. The universe is geometry, not numbers. And so, like, for instance, f of the x equals x squared makes this parabola shape opening upwards. The parabola, or, you know, the shape, is what's real, not x squared. The parabolic arc that ball followed when you threw it up in the air that's what's real, not the equation. So a good way to think of it is the universe is like equations in their natural geometric form in motion interacting with each other, just like numbers. It's one and the same thing. It's beautiful, but of course their way proves it. And so going back to school, it did wonders to help improve my vocabulary. And my vocabulary is still like junior level. It's not like I were at a PhD would be, and I wish it was. But this happened so late in life that I haven't had, the ability to absorb everything I would have if this would have happened like when I was 8. Or even better yet, if this would have happened to Einstein.
Now,
you imagine?
Maureen, you helped Jason navigate getting some official diagnoses of his savant syndrome and a characterization of this. Had you encountered this sort of thing before, or how did you figure out what steps to take?
I had interviewed previously the autistic savant, Daniel Tammet, who Jason and I both really admire. And I knew that there were tests that could be done, and I had been going to consciousness conferences through the University of Arizona for several years at that point. And I reached out to a conference colleague who had a connection at a neuroscience lab, Dr. Barrett Brogard, and told her about Jason's case, and she was immediately fascinated by him and arranged for some scans.
So what did those scans show, and what did that suggest about what had happened?
Well, it proved, if you want to answer this, Jason.
No, go ahead.
It's a little close. Okay. It proved that Jason is seeing things. He is awake in areas of the brain that most of us don't have conscious access to. It also proved his synesthesia.
So, Jason, hearing that and you saying just a few moments ago that you almost wish this had happened sooner, I don't think
right.
There are many people out there who wish that their traumatic brain injury had happened to them.
Right. You know, it's weird. Even though there's bad, like the OCD, it's still there, but now it's under control. Like it 2 years after this had happened, I would not have this bad opinion whatsoever. In fact, that was just horrible. But at the same time, beautiful. Like what I was discovering was beautiful, but the other parts of it were horrible. And I get like body-wide muscle tremors, literally hundreds of times per day, and had to go through all these tests to make sure I didn't have ALS and MS. And it turns out they're just something called benign muscle fasciculations, basically that your muscles move from some sort of neurological condition, but it doesn't look like it's going to kill you. But still, it's really annoying. But yeah, still the good far outweighs the bad. So if it would have happened sooner, I mean, to have time and to have like an 8-year-old's brain who is even more plastic, you know, at that point, the plasticity of the brain is just incredible. You know, what would have happened then, you know, going just when you're learning things that way, you know, who knows how much more it would have been amplified. Because it's definitely, the more I like analyze how it works, each year I get a better understanding of how things work and calculus. I mean, it's amazing. Every day you take calculus, but every single day you see something else that it applies to. It's that endless.
You don't have necessarily the brain plasticity of an 8-year-old, but you certainly seem to have the wonder and awe and curiosity, perhaps, of an 8-year-old. And you say you are never bored.
Yeah, I mean, and I remember before being bored constantly. I remember being bored constantly, and now it's like I can just be sitting in the office for an hour, and it's okay because I can just let my mind go, and instead of just like imagining things like before, I can like see it. I can like make a shape in my head and truly form it, and then zoom in on it and rotate around it, and it's. It's much more entertaining, and it's fun, and you're always finding something new, and it keeps you occupied, and it keeps your brain constantly focused and thinking that way, too. I like to constantly be, like, comparing the way something moves relative to time, you know, it's a long story, but...
Well, apparently one of the trade-offs is that for all of your curiosity and interest in the geometry and mathematics of the natural world, you've lost interest and perhaps ability in other areas related to writing.
Right. Yeah, like I am not a good writer, that's for sure.
And Maureen, that's part of where you stepped in, I take it.
Yes, I felt that Jason had an incredible story to tell. As you can tell, he's tremendously articulate. It's just putting pen to paper is a challenge for him. And while I don't have his vast abilities, I had 25 years experience as a journalist, and I thought we'd make a good team, and I'm really happy he agreed.
Now, you've written essentially a memoir. It's written in the first person as if Jason were writing it. What was your process for actually putting that book together?
It would talk a lot, you know.
Yes.
In fact, I've had people say how well written it is, and I think that's a tribute to Maureen, you know, being able to take everything that we talked about and really put it in a way that's true, but also elegant and done properly. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Well, you can probably tell that Jason is a very rich source. There's plenty of information about him that we couldn't even fit into the book. But he was very generous and probably the most forthcoming source I've ever experienced in journalism. I believed him from the onset, and needless to say, I knew we'd be held to a higher standard of proof than Jason's honesty and my belief in him. And that was part of the reason to get some testing done, too. And we just really spent hundreds and probably thousands of hours on the phone and in email. And we met in New York and at a consciousness conference in Stockholm and road trip together to Wisconsin to see Daryl Treffert, Rain Man's doctor. And I went out to Tacoma as well, Jason's hometown. So we've spent a great deal of time together that finally gave me the comfort level with all the notes and recordings I had that I could channel Jason somehow. And then, of course, at every step of the way, he was being shown, is this right? Is this passage correct? Isn't this exactly what you said? Is this? And so it was a lot of back and forth.
Now, what is it specifically about Jason and his story that you think everyone needs to know? Why is this a book that needed to be written for everyone to read?
First of all, if I may. Yeah, Jason to me is the most affable everyman you could ever consider. If it were an old-time movie, Jimmy Stewart would have to play him. And I think that people can relate to him on a human level very easily. And yet, what is going on with him is so extraordinary. And it tells us something about the hidden potentials, I believe, in all of us. You know, it almost sounds like science fiction to say, yeah, someone can be hit in the head and gain these remarkable skills they didn't have before, from the drawing to the math and physics abilities that Jason has now.
And
there
yet
are
that's
doctors
something
working on this.
That's something that the doctors you encountered said is a rare but known phenomenon, that if you injure one part of the brain, you can awaken another.
Absolutely, yes. And not just one doctor. Dr. Treffert, who is the world's leading authority on savants, who was Kim Peek, Rain Man's doctor, has this theory. Dr. Alan Snyder of Australia has actually created a transcranial stimulator cap that he calls the creativity cap that can induce savant-like skills in normal people. And this is in the literature. This is in the scientific literature. We were fortunate to have the great neuroscientist David Eagleman read our book and the great neuroscientist V.S. Ramachandran. And if you look at the jacket blurbs, they concur. Yes, there are hidden potentials in all of us that this is what this points to.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please, Jason.
Yeah, what I was going to say also is, like, I maybe use this too much, but just when you think about the average things that we do, just by walking and moving and somebody tossing you a ball and you catching it, if you tried to crunch what you just did, catching that ball, you know, into an equation, I mean, you'd have to calculate the acceleration due to gravity, the area of the ball, but the area that it's taking up through space-time and the arc, plus how long it takes the nerve impulses to get from your brain to your fingers, and then the four-dimensional position of your fingers, to grab that ball. I mean, that's a serious equation to crunch, yet you just catch it. And so our body is doing calculus, I mean, for sure. It's just doing it in this instinctive way that we just don't have this conscious access to. We're not thinking those equations, and then catching it, but you're doing them. And I think it's more of a geometric thing, and a brain thing.
So
the brain just analyzing the geometry in this calculus type way.
Right. Now, your writing ability may have declined, but you've alluded a couple of times to your drawings, these very intricate geometric drawings, which I guess you started doing as a way of trying to express to others what it was you were seeing. And you say at one point in the book that if you hadn't drawn these things for other people to see, that you think you would have gone crazy.
Oh, yeah, trying to describe it without the drawing, people can't visualize it. In fact, unless I use like a TV and pixels and things like that, but those were all ways that I learned over time to describe it, But at first, my language wasn't sufficient. And so I had to draw it to show them, because saying a circle is made from triangles sounds crazy, but it's true, It literally is, but it's so counterintuitive that if you can't see it, then if it's counterintuitive, then literally it just sounds ridiculous. And so you got to show it to them. Then once you show it to them, then, oh, yeah, it's obvious. Circles aren't made from triangles, once you see it. The picture is just worth a thousand words,
Maureen, what were you...
You know what? Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I get so excited whenever Jason talks about his triangles and his circle. And just by way of explanation, this is what Archimedes was doing when he was trying to figure pi in ancient times. He would place squares inside and outside of a circle to try to better measure the circle's area. And Jason came to placing triangles inside of his circles to measure them independently. I think I even mentioned Archimedes at one point to Jason, and he had never heard of him.
Yeah, I remember when I first found it, being excited because I thought I discovered it. And that's another reason why it was so much more amazing, is because I wasn't taught it. I discovered it. And so whatever Archimedes felt, I think I felt that same feeling, because I remember the night. I remember fist pumping my hand while running around the house going, I totally get it, And even though I was bummed out when I found out he beat me by quite a bit, that feeling was the same. And I think that's why, that impression will always be so powerful too, is because I had that aha moment, but I had it by myself, and I figured it out by myself, even though...
And that, to me, was perhaps one of the most exciting early moments in getting to know Jason, was just this realization that he had come to this entirely independently. These weren't, whatever was released in his brain, as Dr. Treffert said to me, he said, Maureen, you have to understand, nothing was added or created here. It's not like Jason had been exposed to this and some memory was released after the brain damage, right? It's not learning that was
like
forgotten.
Yeah.
It wasn't there.
Well, so, one neat thing, too, is that I just got in contact, or she just emailed me, Tracy Haney was my first teacher that I went to, and for like my first three math classes at TCC, and she's now at UW, and I came into her class with all the drawings, and so from day one, like when I came to her class, school had already been going for a week, and she said, it's too late to get in, and I was like, no, please, please, because this guy had convinced me to go in, and she said, here's a test, and it was a test on slope. And like the point slope equation, and I struggled. She said, "If you can pass this, then I'll let you in the class." And I struggled that whole weekend to learn that silly thing because I didn't even know what it was. And then I passed it, and then she let me in. And I had all my drawings with me, and I had them written in funky little equations that I had made up myself to represent, things. but not the traditional equations, you know, and the traditional, you know, letters. And I remember, you know, as I learned, erasing them and writing the correct ones, you know, although they were both describing the same thing. I had to do it in their language, not my own little funny one. But she saw all those when I came in, and I was telling her, this is pi, this is pi. In fact, she left to have her twins before I hit trig and actually wrote the equation to prove it, that those drawings were pi. But I just sent her an email with the equations.
I'm talking with Jason Padgett and Maureen Seberg, co-authors of Struck by Genius. More after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Jason Padgett has been through an amazing transformation over the past 11 years, from college dropout and self-described party boy to mathematical genius. He and co-author Maureen Seberg describe that experience in their new book, Struck by Genius, How a Brain Injury Made Me a Mathematical Marvel. Padgett's story doesn't end there. He's re-enrolled in college, but he's also still working as a furniture salesman for his family's business.
Why continue that as opposed to, say, just going to school and becoming a mathematician or a physicist?
It's been this big struggle. First of all, like when all this was happening, I've had a lot of medical problems that they haven't been talking about too much. Like I was down to 120 pounds or 124 pounds.
And where did you start weight-wise?
Oh, like 150. So I'm 5'8" and I was 124. I was super, super tiny, and I'd just been sick, and I wound up having like gallbladder sludge, but it wasn't gallbladder stone, so it took them like 3 years to diagnose, and I haven't been able to eat. But the reason why I stay at the store is there's a multitude of reasons. I went to school and did the store when it was easier, like to work with my dad, and he had other people working, and as time's gone by, he's gotten older. And mentally, things have been changing. So
yeah, his three stores support two households.
Right.
So not just Jason's livelihood, but his father's household depends on him.
Yeah,
so as he has aged, it's become even more important that Jason be there.
Now, Jason, you're also married and have a daughter. How has your family been impacted by this whole process?
My wife has never known me besides like this. And one thing, that's another reason why we're 2 years, 3 years after it, it would have been horrible, but now it has a wonderful positive spin, is because life is changing to where it looks like I'm very likely going to be able to get out of the furniture store because now I can make a living, you know, doing math, whereas before I couldn't make a living and couldn't even pay, you know, my own medical bills, literally. But when I went back to school, I met my wife, and now we're having a baby in exactly 79 days if she comes on time. So we have a new daughter that's coming. So if I wouldn't have gotten mugged, I wouldn't have gone back to school, I wouldn't have met my wife, and this baby wouldn't be coming. And my daughter, who is my older daughter, was from a previous relationship, but her mom and I, we get along fine, and she's almost 17. She just got her license. She's got straight A's in school, doing Head Start, and so, you know, again, all these things now seem to be wonderful. You know, if I look back at that event, it actually caused a lot of good things to happen in the long run.
A lot of teenage girls hit a point where, for whatever reason, math becomes less interesting. Did your daughter ever go through that? And did you ever talk with her about your vision and your perspective?
Oh yeah, she was like my soundboard. But it's funny that because, like, I mean, one of the biggest moments, you know, where things crystallized in my mind, what happened while I was talking to Megan, and she couldn't have been more, she was little, and she asked me how the TV worked, and I said, oh, little rectangle pixels change color, or little square pixels change color, and that changes the picture. And right as I said that, a commercial for Overstock.com came on, and she goes, that's wrong. It's impossible to make a circle with rectangles or squares. And it was just like, poof, it was there that's exactly it. You know, the pixels get smaller to infinity, you know, that thing that I was describing earlier. But that was one of those moments, and it happened with her. And of course, when those things happen, I told her about it, you know, and I explained it to her. And so she's heard all of this her whole life, so she knows pi probably better than anybody else. And she's not even into math that much. You know, she likes it. She's good at it. And I did tell her, like, before she, you know, became a teenager, I remember telling her that, hey, pretty soon I'm going to be totally embarrassing just because you're a teenager. So expect that to happen and expect everything I say to be stupid, you know, and try to fight against it. And then I actually remember at some point she was 13 or 14 and she's like, Dad. And I said, yeah. She's like, oh, I'm feeling that thing that you were telling me about. She goes, but I'm fighting it. And what was funny is that her whole teenage phase only lasted like 9 months to a year, and now she's totally grown up. She's 16, almost 17, but she's like got her day regimented. She goes to school, she works, gets straight A's. She's happy. Has had the same boyfriend for like 3 years, and he's nice, and they get along. And it's just like, wow, it's just weird. It seems like she really fast got through that teenage phase, and I wonder if it's because we talked so much about, you know, everything. You know, I would tell her about everything. We'd philosophize, you know, about the universe and numbers and things like that. But even at a younger age, you know, so she grew up with these concepts. I would love for more kids to grow up with it, because when you hit algebra and you understand pi defines all slope, all angles, and there's a lot to it. You know, but it's still easy to understand. And once you understand it, by defining all angles, it defines all the angles that's in geometry. In any figure, you break it down into its little angles, like a wire structure. And so everything breaks down into pi somehow. You know, in the universe being geometry, you understand pi, you really start to see the connection between a lot of equations from where they come from, instead of just memorizing an equation and getting the right answer that you don't even know why you're memorizing the equation. Whereas this way, it's much more exciting for kids because they really understand it and they see how it can apply. And there's ways to show them like where they can see it in the real world. Like when you see the double rainbow, you're looking at the geometry of pi.
So if you were to pursue a career in mathematics, what would you like to do? Would it be research on a particular topic or perhaps being a teacher?
I think being a teacher would be best because, like I said, now I'm 43, almost 44, and it seems like the best thing I could do is spread this. And one thing it seems like that I'm best at is like inspiring kids to get excited about it. You know, I talk to kids or classes and, you know, they can be all rowdy at first, and in 5 minutes, they're just in rapt attention when you start getting into, like, relativity, and you do it in a fun, cool way, and in a way that's real, and that they can understand. Like, do you want me to explain relativity real quick? It takes, like, a minute and a half, but kids love it because it really helps them to expand on their view of how the world and the universe works.
I absolutely want to hear the 90-second version of relativity.
Okay. Okay. So there's a lot of us have heard of this, but I'll say it just in case, you know, for everybody. There's this thing called the Doppler effect, which is how waves are interpreted based on, you know, your motion relative to something else. So we've all heard a car drive by us or a motorcycle go really fast by us, and it goes, and it changes pitch. Well, short wavelengths of sound, we hear that as a high pitch, and long wavelengths of sound we hear as a low pitch. I actually have a drawing of this that makes it easier, but you can still explain it. So as the motorcycle is coming towards you, the sound wave is leaving it, but since the sound wave is moving towards you, it gets kind of squished together, which makes shorter wavelengths, and you hear the pitch getting higher. And then the motorcycle goes by you and goes, and as now that it's moving away from you, the waves stretch out and get longer, and you hear the pitch getting lower. But then you add relativity to it, and say you're on one corner of a block and your friend's on the other corner of the block, and I'm driving away from you towards them. So as I'm driving away from you, since I'm moving away from you, the waves are stretching out, you hear the pitch getting lower, but I'm relative to your friend's position, I'm moving towards them, so they hear the pitch getting higher because the waves are getting shorter. I'm in the car traveling with the wave, so there's no Doppler effect to me, so I hear a medium pitch. And what you do is you stop right there and say, what sound is it making? The low pitch to you, the medium pitch to me, or the high pitch to your friend? And it's making all three sounds relative to who's looking at it. And then you say, which sound is the real reality? All three are the real reality. They're just relative. And then you take the very last step and say, now imagine an infinite number of people all looking at that same car, and every one of them is moving at a different speed from zero to the speed of light. Every one of them hears a different sound, and every reality is real but relative. And that gives you this understanding of when they talk about alternate universes and things like that, that's where the concept comes from. And that Doppler effect applies to color. So if you see my shirt is blue, is it really blue? it could be perceived as any color based on the position and velocity of the observer and the observed. Like if I have a blue shirt and you have a twin and your twin and I shot away from you at the speed of light, you would see my shirt stretch into longer wavelengths, which is red, but your twin traveling with me at close to speed of light would see my shirt as blue because there would be no Doppler effect. And then again, you'd say, what color is my shirt, blue or red? It's both. And again, with an infinite number of observers, my shirt is every color. And that's really how it works. And so, but I normally don't go into the light thing. I just do the car.
I wish I had had a math teacher like you when I was in school.
Yeah, because it's crazy because the kids are just like, oh, my God. I remember this one kid like looking at a girl because there was a band that came into class and telling her something like, there's some universe, you know, there's a version that you like me. And she was like, not this one, but I don't know. It might have been that one, the way that they were flirting. It was funny. But it's neat to explain that to them. And they can test it for themselves by, like, filming it. What I tell them is, I say, if you ever want to prove it, film it on two different cameras. Film your buddy driving down his car between two different cameras and then play both films on two separate TVs side by side. And you'll hear the high pitch in one and the low pitch in the other. It's just you're never in both positions at the same time to hear that difference in reality.
Maureen, I wonder if you could leave us with what you see as perhaps the lessons that we could learn from Jason's experience and from his story, you know, shy of some sort of actual brain manipulation. What can we learn from Jason?
I think it's two things. Number one, the triumph of the human spirit. If you have a positive attitude, as Jason does, and a strong will, you can overcome so very much. And this is even knowing that Jason is much more fortunate than most traumatic brain injury individuals. But certainly he's had so many trade-offs, and he's come through them. So I think that positive attitude is really a takeaway from this book and his story. And secondly, that more and more resources need to be devoted to brain research. We close our book with a quote from Dr. William Newsom of President Obama's new brain initiative. And that's a very exciting development in neuroscience. Just like the space program, our government is earmarking at first, $100 million toward better technology in brain research. And I believe in the 2015 budget, they're talking about $200 million, doubling it. And if Jason isn't proof of the dormant potential in us all, there are several other savants who also acquired this later in life who further prove it. And I think that we do need this research and we need the resources to develop safe ways to enhance human potential. So, again, on a personal level, it's this positivity and willfulness. And on a bigger level, I think we as a society, as a world, need to shift our priorities away from warring and destruction to wonderful things that can get everyone excited, like the potential for the human mind.
Maureen Seberg, Jason Padgett, thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can follow Living Lab Radio on Twitter or like us on Facebook. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.